This is Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet.
Good evening, and thank you for tuning into Eco Radio KC. On tonight's program, Bridging the Gap's executive director speaks with our host, Richard Mabian, about their new Green Pocketbook program. But first, I'm Natural Lee with your environmental news headlines. GreenAbilityMagazine.com reports, the White House and U.S. Department of Energy named the Greater Kansas City region as one of 16 Climate Action Champion communities in the United States. The Climate Action Champions competition was designed to identify and recognize local climate leaders and provide targeted federal support to help selected communities further their efforts to reduce carbon pollution and build resilience. The Mid-American Regional Council applied for the designation in partnership with the City of Kansas City, Missouri, Johnson County, Kansas, and Bridging the Gap. This award means that the Kansas City region will have access to future funding opportunities that are available specifically for climate action champions, as well as a wide range of technical assistance, including access to renewable energy experts, a peer network, validated climate data, participation in resilience planning exercises, and partnerships with federal facilities. The full list of climate action champions is available online at whitehouse.gov. KOMU.com reports, Independence, Missouri officials are considering constructing the state's largest solar farm as part of a continuing push to expand the city's use of renewable energy. In July, the city set a goal of having Independence Power and Light producing at least 10% of its power from renewable energy by 2018 and 15% by 2021. City Manager Robert Heacock says companies from around the country interested in building solar farms have contacted the city. The Independence Examiner reports that interest prompted the city to extend its deadline to submit proposals to December 23rd. Heacock says he thinks the city could reach its goal of 10% by 2016 or 2017. The plan is to use the land in Northeast Independence for a solar farm that would produce about 10 megawatts. ThankProgress.org reports, a group of Catholic bishops called on the world's government to end fossil fuel use on Wednesday, citing climate change's threat to the global poor as the lodestar of their concern. According to the BBC, the statement is the first time senior officials in the church from every continent have issued such a call. The bishops' logic and their goal for restraining temperature increase is rooted in prioritizing, quote, the immediate needs of the most vulnerable communities, end quote. The UN report also determined that there is currently a massive gap between what the developing countries will need and what the developed world is willing to pay, a point of considerable tension in the international talks. While China has overtaken the United States as the biggest cumulative emitter, the U.S. maintains a far higher level of emissions per capita. Furthermore, climate change is cumulative, meaning the bulk of the effects are still driven by the carbon the U.S. and the rest of the Western world historically emitted in the course of building their wealth. Quote, those responsible for climate change have responsibilities to assist the most vulnerable in adapting and managing loss and damage and to share the necessary technology and know-how, end quote, the bishops continue, while insisting that 50% of all climate-related public funding go to meet the developing world's adaptation needs. While this is a first by some markers, the bishops' statement also continues a long tradition of engagement with environmental issues and climate change by the Catholic Church. Pope Francis himself has made the religious case for combating climate change, warning that, quote, if we destroy creation, creation will destroy us, end quote. That's all for the news.
All right. Thank you, Naturally. My name is Mike Murphy. And before we get to Mr. Mabian, I just wanted to let folks know about a couple of interesting things coming up on KKFI. On Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., Vandana Shiva, an internationally renowned voice for sustainable development and social justice, physicist, scholar, and social activist. She will be speaking on radical compassion. That will be the topic of her talk Wednesday morning at 9 on Alternative Radio, right after Democracy Now! And also wanted to let folks know about the one-hour special from IEEE Spectrum, Future Car, which explores the latest technological advances for the automobile and previews cars we may see in the not-too-distant future. That's the Thursday night special at 7. And then Generation Green, Fulfilling the Promise of Jobs and Justice on Bioneers. That's Friday morning at 9:30. We're going to turn things over to Mr. Mabian right after these messages.
If your unemployment benefits have been denied in the last 30 days, you may be eligible for free legal assistance from attorneys and law students through the UMKC School of Law Unemployment Benefits Clinic. To find out if you are eligible for these free legal services, your unemployment benefits must have been denied in the last 30 days. Contact the clinic today and talk to an attorney about your case free of charge. Call 816-235-5129. Again, call 816-235-5129.
It's hard to think of a time when a free press is more necessary than when the public needs to know about crimes committed in our name. So the release of a Senate report on CIA torture is a test for U.S. media. We'll hear about the report and the media response on Counterspin, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., right after Radioactive Magazine.
Okay. This is Richard Mabian, and recently I was at a stormwater symposium and ran into the, I guess she's the director of Bridging the Gap, Kristen Riott, and she started telling me about a food program, a food production program that I had thought was kind of interesting. So I asked her if she would come in and she and I could talk about it, and we'd be able to share it with you all. So, Kristen, first of all, let me say welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Well, this is your first time being with me.
No.
Or something.
No, on your show. But I'm an old hand at KKFY.
I mean, I can't believe that. You know, I started thinking back. Do you remember when we first met? Can you remember?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Okay, but do you remember the exact occasion?
No, you got me there.
All right, okay.
Because you're ubiquitous. You're everywhere.
I was attending a meeting at Bob Berkebile's house.
Oh, yes.
You had just got hired with Bridging the Gap.
You've got a better memory than
can
I
you
do.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And you came in the room and they introduced you and Murdoch. What's his name? Murdoch.
Phelps. Yeah, Phelps
there.
Murdoch. Yep.
And we all sat out. We had that was the very first time, and you were coming from the Al Gore thing, and I was just impressed with you.
Oh,
I was sitting
you're
here
very kind.
And then I've just
well, we've been friends ever since.
And I've sat on the sideline and watched you as you have. Manipulating and work this business, and you've done a fantastic job.
Well, you're kind. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I mean, I'm very impressed. You know, people may not know you, but they know of Bridging the Gap, and a lot of that has been your efforts. So.
Well, we've been around for a long time, yeah. But we've got a new program to talk about today.
Yes. When I want to hear about this food program. Kind of share with folks about it.
Yeah, well, we call it Green Pocketbook.
Let's start right there. How did that come up, pocketbook?
Well, the idea of it is that there's a lot of power in how we spend our dollars to help the environment or to actually do environmental damage. And so if you've got a green pocketbook, you're helping the world go green, but you're also saving green at the same time.
Okay.
So your pocketbook is stuffed with green bills because you don't have to spend as much when you're really focusing on helping the environment.
So it's not gender specific?
No, actually, you know, we know women are oftentimes the big, you know, we got a lot of power, don't you,
right.
Richard? In our
right.
households, women
yeah.
tend to be
yeah.
kind of the boss.
Yeah, kind of puts you in a certain
yeah.
area.
Yeah, so we tend to be the spenders, we tend to be the decision makers, but certainly men are involved in this too, and we welcome men to the table as well.
Okay.
But we have been working primarily with women's groups around town.
Okay, now tell us about the program.
So just to a little bit of background. Bridging Gap is always involved in environmental education, and we try to kind of figure out where people are and develop our programs in a way that will bring something new maybe to the party. And this program, what I love about it is that it helps people understand that the direction of individual health and the direction of our community's environmental health and the direction of saving money are all the same direction. And so you can eat healthy, you can save money on your grocery bills, and you can help the environment all at the same time. And I'm really grateful that that's the case, because I'd have a lot of cognitive dissonance if that weren't the case, if it didn't actually help people all in the same direction.
I like the fact you put those together. I think sometimes we separate it. I don't think sometimes the health people realize how much they are really a part of the environment and this environmental movement.
Yeah, there are a lot of areas of overlap. So there are also lots of things that we talk about under the Green Pocketbook heading, including how to make your home more energy efficient, unplugging a lot of unnecessary appliances. For example, the average American household has more than two refrigerators per household, and refrigerators run 24/7 and they use electricity 24/7. Mm-hmm. So, and they're often the food that's out in that second refrigerator has been out there for a while. So, for example, one thing that you could do is go home and unplug that second refrigerator and see if you can operate out of one of them instead of two.
That's good, because, and also a lot of times those second refrigerators is less efficient than the ones that they're buying nowadays.
Exactly.
And that's the Sierra Club is doing a bit right now with having this people replacing their refrigerators. But part of the agreement is that the old refrigerator has to leave the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, because of the efficiency factor.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. That's exactly right. But so there's a lot about energy efficiency that we can talk about with Green Pocketbook, but I'd like to focus first on the question of food.
Yes.
Because I think people know a lot about energy efficiency, but they might not know as much about the relationship between food and the environment.
Okay.
So, and not just food, but anything that you would shop for in a grocery store, for example. So let's just say that any product that we buy, if we're wandering down the aisles of the grocery store, and let's say we're in that beverage aisle, right? Mm. There's a lot of stuff in that beverage aisle. It's a big aisle. And generally, that product, we're paying for every aspect of that product. We're paying for the manufacturer of the bottle. We're paying for that. The liquid that's inside of it. We're paying for all of the energy and the resources that those things represent, and we're also paying for it to be transported generally over hundreds of miles. And so all of those factors have a real impact, as you know, on our planet. We've got pollution that's associated with trucking. We've got coal-fired electricity that's associated with manufacturing in this part of the country. And so on. And all of that is something that people are paying for. So let's take the example of bottled water, for example. And you know where I'm going to be coming from on this. Right. I'm not a fan of it. We've got great water in the city of Kansas City, Missouri. In fact, some of the best water in the world right here in Kansas City, Missouri. And yet we still have households spending between 6 and 15% of their household income on bottled water, which is just crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And bottled water creates a lot of environmental impacts. First of all, there are 37,000 trucks on U.S. highways every year hauling water from one place to the next, and that water is no better than what we have right here. Those trucks are putting out a lot of pollution. There are 50 billion plastic water bottles going in U.S. landfills every year just for water, not for iced tea and the other stuff. And that represents oil, and you know the whole story about oil, so we're not even going to go there. But the point is, in the beverage aisle, you don't need that bottled water.
Right.
So that's the first. In many cases, it can be $900 a year that a household is spending on bottled water. So there's $900 back in your pocket right there. Now, some people say, well, it doesn't taste the same,
right.
You know. And then we say, well, get yourself a Brita pitcher if you want to do it smaller scale, or you can have one of these processing things put in under your sink that will filter the water,
mm-hmm.
and you can have the filters changed out once a year. You will still save money doing that versus buying bottled water from a store. So that starts with bottled water. Now, let's take a look around the rest of the grocery store and think of other things that we might be buying and how they might affect our health and our pocketbook and our environment. Let's go for a second to, let's stay in the beverage aisle, okay?
Right.
Because let's stay there right there for a second. And let's look around and see some of the other products that are on the shelves, like soda pop. Right?
Yeah, I was thinking that when you were speaking. And energy drinks. Those energy drinks.
Yeah.
Another one.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I actually happen to have some of these figures in my head about soda pop. Teenagers continue to increase their consumption of soda pop. Mm-hmm. It's gone up since about 2007. It's gone up fairly significantly, maybe another 10%. And we now have teenagers, I'm going to say on average, about 65% of teenagers are drinking one can of soda pop a day at least. Now that's 230 calories, mostly sugar. It rots their teeth. It's hard on their stomachs. Mm-hmm. There's some evidence that it's actually leaching calcium out of bones. And it's costing them money. And I think maybe even the most important thing of all is it makes healthy food taste pretty dull by comparison, because that big hit of sugar kind of adapts your palate to really high stimulation. It's like kind of, you know, it's kind of like morphine, I guess.
Yeah, I was in a store the other day, and they had the quart bottles of Coke and of cooler right there by the checkout stand for a dollar. And I thought about that. Like how easy it is to buy this. I mean, a quart, big old quart bottle, you know, for a dollar. And that's,
yeah,
that makes it, you know, that makes it easy for you to sit there and go, oh, well, a dollar, that's no big deal.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, as we go out talking with people about Green Pocketbook, they say, but this kind of food is so cheap.
Yeah.
Well, it's not cheap because you just spent a dollar on it.
Right.
It's spending more. It's spending a dollar more than you should be spending. And that is not accounting for all of the health costs in this country that are being driven by the consumption of highly sugary foods.
Right.
Staying on that sugar theme for a minute, and I confess right now over KKFI radio that I am a sugarholic myself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I love sugar. Very few days in my life that I haven't eaten, and I think until really the past year, I've been trying to get off of it. And when I say get off of it, I'm serious about that, because it actually is an addictive substance. Sugar fires up the same parts of your brain that morphine does.
Mm-hmm.
And it really is. It's been shown in laboratory rats and so on that they actually, particularly combined with butter, sugar and butter, my favorite combination, it's just really hard to stop eating that. It's literally very addictive. Yeah.
And we don't realize how much we eat has sugar in it.
Actually, the average American is eating about 75 pounds a year of white sugar and another 75 pounds a year of other sweeteners like corn syrup and fructose and things like that.
Yes.
So I used to think that as a small woman trying to keep my calories down, well, it's no big deal. Sugar's just empty calories and it just goes on through your body and it's, you know, it's not a real health hazard. But maybe some of our listeners have caught the piece that 60 Minutes did in the past year or so. I think it's a Dr. Lux, L-U-X, something like that, was on 60 Minutes. You can probably Google it. And it turns out that sugar is devastating to the body. There's it drives heart disease. It drives liver disease. It is not a free pass through the body.
Right.
And so our kids drinking these intensive sugary drinks on a daily basis is really as bad for them as smoking cigarettes.
So, you know, I'm sitting here as you're speaking. And of course, you know, I'm one of those persons, your mind rolls as people are talking. You know, they say when someone's speaking to you, your mind is thinking 800 times that rate that the person speaking with an answer for what they're saying. So that's why a lot of times people don't hear.
That's why you're always ahead of me.
Yeah, because
I'm always talking and you're always thinking.
Well, that's why people don't always hear what you're saying too. but I was just, the effort that's being put forth by environmental groups to close coal fire plants or to deal with the issues of our health should be going into the issues of our food. When you were speaking about that, we should all be directing our attention toward this sugar consumption. And I know for a fact, as a person that teaches environmental literacy, I spend very little time talking about food consumption, the sugar that's in food.
Well, and it's, you know, again, we're hauling heavy liquids around the country to transport this stuff. And the bottles are going into our landfills and the pollution is going into the atmosphere and so on. Now, I am not saying for a minute that it is easy to give up this stuff. Oh, it is not easy to give up this or any other addiction, but acknowledgement is the first step. Awareness is the first step. And then maybe telling somebody you love about your desire to reduce. Reduce is one way. As my mom's a long-term member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and tapering off is one way that you can get off of things that other people like cold turkey. But certainly for mothers and fathers out there, one of the best things that you can do for your kids is to stop buying it. Right. You may not have access to the vending machines that they're around or their friends' houses, but you can stop buying it and put that money into their college education.
You know, at that meeting I said when I first met you, I probably got one of my most important environmental messages from Phelps Murdoch. And he said that when we leave here, you'll be talking, when you leave here, Richard, you'll be talking to people about things that they know nothing about. And it's kind of like the end results area. We're talking about where are we going. He said, but in life, you have three phases. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And most of what we're doing right now is at the beginning. Mm-hmm. Well, the beginning of any process is education. Mm-hmm. And see, and that's where we are. We need to really focus our attention in on educating the masses. And even though, like you say, it's not easy to give up, by doing this, creating these educational opportunities, we're benefiting our future generations. And that's where my whole direction is going right now, even in what you're talking about, is to be able to educate that future generation to kind of give them a different mindset of what food is really about.
Right. So, okay, we're stuck in the beverage aisle. Let's move on to to another part of the grocery store. Let's look at the meat aisle for a second. Now, the production of a pound of beef is a very resource-intensive thing. It takes, in conventional large-scale agriculture, it takes about 15 or 16 pounds of grain to feed the cattle to produce 1 pound of beef. It takes about 2,000 gallons of water to grow the 15 pounds of grain to produce the single pound of beef, okay?
Okay.
So beef is actually one of the most resource-intensive products there in the grocery store. Now, there's one that's even more, and that's lamb, surprisingly enough. It takes a lot of inputs, and there's not a lot of meat on the bone. So lamb is even higher than beef. But the one that we eat the most is beef. And, of course, men, by the way, and I'm looking at you, buddy, are actually eat even more beef per day than women do. And African-American men eat the most of all. Mm-hmm. So on average, as Americans, we're eating about a half pound of meat per day and maybe more. And if you're a teenage boy, you're certainly eating more.
Right.
So there's a lot of... We could have a long conversation about nutrition and diet and so on, but there is some evidence that we're overdoing it on protein. We don't need that much protein. As a matter of fact, what we're doing is we're eating a whole lot of protein and we're eating very little in the way of produce. And we're going to go to the produce aisle in just a little bit.
I want to keep in mind of our time, we got to watch it, but when you talk about green pocketbooks, not only are you talking about the green that's inside the pocketbooks, you're also talking about the green knowledge that should be in those pocketbooks about what you're buying.
Exactly.
Because so far what we've been talking about is the knowledge we need to have about these different roles.
Right.
I'm loving that.
Right. So now, I am not saying to you or anybody else that you need to become a vegetarian.
Yeah, I heard you direct your comment to me. Made me feel like I'm overweight or something.
No, I'm eating
too much meat.
No. But, I mean, it's just such a big part of our culture.
Right.
And it's such a big part of our celebrations and our sharing together. And the hamburger is sort of it's a universal symbol for American food.
If the Chiefs get a sack, you can go get a Big Mac and buy one and get one free.
Well, and here we are in Kansas City, the barbecue capital of the world, right?
Yes,
so,
yes.
And I'm not saying you can't have it, but I'm saying maybe we don't have it twice a day at the level that we're having it.
Right.
The other thing I just want to say is it's no coincidence that the price of beef is going up. The reason is because you're paying for all the resources that beef represents.
Right.
So if you're going to have your beef and you're going to serve it to your family, one thing to do, for example, at home, let's say you're not at down at Arthur Bryan's, right, but you could slice it real thinly and do it in a stir fry like the Chinese people do and have a lot of other vegetables in there as well and make that piece go of meat go quite a bit further. Or you can have a bean burrito on a Monday night. The KCMO public school system has declared Meatless Mondays.
Okay.
So has the San Diego public school
system.
Meatless
Mondays?
Meatless Mondays, okay. Yeah. It's kind of a trending thing.
Right.
So we at Bridging the Gap really like to encourage people to try what we call small proteins. And I'm talking about things like beans.
Okay.
I'm talking about nuts. I'm talking about peanut butter. Not everybody likes dairy, but I love cottage cheese, and I think that's one of the best values in the grocery store. For about $2.50 at my grocery store, you can buy a container of cottage cheese, and there'll be, I don't know, 8 servings in there, half cup servings. Every one of those servings has 12 grams of protein in it. It's about, you know, maybe almost a third of what you need, what a woman my size needs for the day.
Okay.
So there are lots of other ways to get protein. And by the way, romaine lettuce has protein in it. You eat a big bunch of romaine lettuce. Absolutely, it's got protein. That's how pandas and giraffes and buffalo and a lot of other big mammals, big meaty mammals, get their living. They eat, they're herbivores. They eat salad.
This is why I thought when you started talking about this, it's so interesting because there's things in here we can teach. Now, we're running out of our time. I want to hit the produce aisle before we get out of here, and I want to know how you are applying this, how you're going about applying this program that you have.
Okay, well, one of the things that we hear from our audience is that there's the perception that the produce aisle is expensive.
Okay.
And indeed, because produce has water in it, it's heavier per pound. But the fact is, the price per pound is cheaper than cookies and chips and meat and a lot of other things. And if we're not eating as much junk food, we're freeing up a little bit of money to spend in that produce aisle. Same thing with bottled water and the beverages. We can spend a little bit more of our money in the produce aisle. Now, it's cold weather. It's a wonderful time for soups. It's a wonderful time to cut up a bunch of vegetables, put a little olive oil and salt on them, and shove them in the oven to roast. Turn them once after 20 minutes, and you've got a beautiful pan of kind of caramelized vegetables. And you can really combine them almost any way you want, with root vegetables this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll put eggplant and tomatoes and onions in there, and it just makes a wonderful kind of a stew almost to serve over pasta or rice. So really exploring the produce aisle, that's really where we need to be eating about half of our food intake. And I think when you eliminate some of these other things, you're helping your body, you're helping the environment, and you're helping your pocketbook.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think where we run into problems is people actually knowing how to prepare the food.
Yeah.
That's a key that I'm hoping that the programs like you have, in addition to that program, will be actually showing people how to prepare the food. In the work that I do, I see that as being a missing area of doing it.
You're right. And people are out of the habit of cooking because they've are busy and they're running around and it's hard to plan for it. But habit has a lot to do with this.
I know this because just the nature of my work, I'm around a lot of elderly from time to time. And I'm talking up in the 80s, and they're still viable and fry and jumping around. I have a former that's about 86 years old. Y'all have heard me talk to Joe Jennings. And he eats a lot of vegetables. And he knows how to cook the vegetables.
Awesome.
I'll be going by there. I mean, and he is squash crazy because he got all these different ways you can cook squash, you know. And
I used to be scared of squash, but now I'm not scared of it anymore.
And you start realizing how that was part of their culture. Y'all don't know if you're familiar with this term biomimicry.
Mm-hmm,
they're
sure.
Starting to teach that. Well, I was doing some study on that the other day. And it talked about how one of the keys to the biomimicry style of making decisions or finding solutions is to find out how the previous generations survived. and you use what they did to survive as a means for creating the solutions for the here and now. And immediately I started going, that's like these 80-year-olds who knew how to cook and knew how
to save things and not waste them.
And yeah. I said, those things need to be pinpointed and shown to these now generations of things that they did back in the days that was able to survive.
Yeah, we don't want to lose our wisdom, that's for sure.
Well, we have maximized our time. Folks, I hope you have had a chance to kind of hear what she's saying. Is there any way people could find out more about what we've been talking about?
You know, this program is so new, we don't really have a presence on our website yet, but if you go to bridgingthegap.org and just click on Contact Us, you can reach somebody at Bridging the Gap that can help you with it.
Okay, that's great. And if you ever do get something that we can use as a link, let us know and we'll put it on Eco Radio link.
Okay,
so people
awesome.
Can go
That's
in and make a link. Hey, I appreciate you coming by and sitting down having this conversation with us. It's really been fun. Those of you who know me realize it must have captivated my attention because you haven't heard my mouth nearly as much as you do when I'm on the air. So thank you for coming
thank
in
you
and
so
come
much,
back and
Richard,
see us
for
again.
An opportunity. You bet, I will.
90.1 FM is in the middle of our online holiday auction. You can go to kkfi.org/events for more information about the auction. Hundreds of services from foot massage to gardening, concerts, plays, gift certificates, CDs, DVDs, and even some home-cooked meals. That's kkfi.org/events. Happy holidays to you and yours from 90.1 FM, KKFI. And remember, the auction ends Monday, December 15th at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Vandana Shiva speaks on radical compassion on Alternative Radio, Wednesday morning at 9.
This week on The Bioneers.
We are about to leave our children with a mess. What we can do now is make an investment so that our children will at least have a chance to turn this mess around.
I'm Neil Harvey. This week it's Generation Green. Fulfilling the promise of jobs and justice on The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
Friday morning at 9:30, right before Eclectics.
Fighting for the climate in the heart of the world. I am Amy Goodman with my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast, broadcasting from Lima, Peru. Lima, the capital of Peru, has become a city of gustatory renown, attracting foodies from the world over to sample dishes from its famous ceviche to favorites from the Andean highlands. So it's an appropriate place, perhaps, for what's become a genuine movable feast, the world-roving series of summits organized by the United Nations to tackle the crisis of climate change. This year's meeting, known as COP20, the 20th Conference of Parties to the Kyoto Protocol, is the last high-level meeting with presidents and prime ministers before the December 2015 climate summit in Paris. The Paris meeting is supposed to produce an extension of the Kyoto Protocol, a new global legally binding treaty that restricts global warming to an increase in average global temperatures to just 2 degrees Celsius, that's 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. As such, all eyes are on Paris. But if the devil is in the details, it's here in Lima that the details are being worked out. You can't spell climate without Lima. That's L-I-M-A. First, it's necessary to understand the setting and who's at the table and who isn't. Inside, the summit proceeds in an orderly manner with UN police standing watch and a rarefied air of diplomatic decorum. It's hard to feel any sense of urgency. This is astounding, as the science is clear. The world is warming rapidly, and without action, catastrophic climate change will soon become irreversible. The official COP20 is being held on the grounds of the Peruvian Army headquarters, ominously named El Pentagonito, or the Little Pentagon. In this militarized zone, the UN climate summit occurs in a Potemkin village with formal ceremonies and intermittent pre-approved protests. The imagery is not lost on many Peruvians organizing for climate justice. Wilfredo Saavedra Maredos, president of the Environmental Defense Front of Cajamarca, told Democracy Now! NewsHour,
COP20 is nothing more than a kind of deception. It's a farce. That's how we perceive it. The representatives of the states of the world are meeting in a place that is stained with blood. In the Pentagonito, that military base, They have extrajudicially executed our brothers. They have burned them. They have disappeared them.
Outside in the bustling city streets of Lima, a city of more than 8 million people with interminable traffic jams, grassroots activists are hosting their own Cumbre de los Pueblos, a people summit on climate change, in a public park across town. On December 10th, Human Rights Day, thousands of people marched through the streets demanding genuine action on climate change. Pasco Sabido, with the group Corporate Europe Observatory, or CEO, is organizing both inside and outside the COP20. Together with other groups, he released a report titled Corporate Conquistadors, the many ways multinationals both drive and profit from climate destruction. At one action inside, Sabido and others descended on a meeting sponsored by oil giant Shell, Chevron, and other fossil fuel interests.
There was lots and lots of very angry and active people there trying to protest against the presence of the fossil fuel industry here in these talks.
Pasco told me.
20 years we've been going without progressing towards a sort of climate deal, a fair, ambitious climate deal that we need. And one of the big reasons is because of the aggressive lobbying of the fossil fuel industry, both at national level and here in the talks.
Another organizer at COP20 is the Nigerian environmental leader Nimo Bassi. He says,
before I left Nigeria, my temperature was gauged twice. And that was to know if I have high fever or if I had Ebola. Now, the temperature of the Earth has gone 0.8 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. If the planet Earth were to go through the same process I went through, the Earth would have been quarantined because the Earth would have been adjudged to have high fever or Ebola. But we can't quarantine the Earth. We need to find who are the climate criminals and quarantine them.
It's also important to note who isn't here at COP20. Yeb Sanyo was the lead climate negotiator for the Philippines last year. To the shock of many, he was pulled from the delegation this year and his home as his nation is devastated by yet another typhoon, Hagupit. Sanyo tweeted, "They can silence my mouth, but they cannot silence my soul." Sanyo made waves at COP19 in Warsaw, Poland. The Philippines was being hit then by Typhoon Haiyan. Sanyo wasn't sure if his family had survived. In an emotional address to the summit, he asked,
"If not us, then who? If not now, then when? If not here, then where?"
Many climate activists from the Philippines think concerted pressure from the U.S. and European governments prompted Sanyo's removal, as he was becoming a forceful proponent of climate justice for the global south. Atossa Soltani, founder of the nonprofit organization Amazon Watch, told me that despite all the COP's deficiencies, she's still glad this global gathering is here in Peru, where more than 60% of the country, an area the size of Texas, is rainforest.
It's the first COP ever in an Amazon country, and the Amazon is incredibly important in the climate debate, both because deforestation is a huge source of emissions, but also because the rainforests of the Amazon actually are the rain machine for the planet. They create these flying rivers that basically provide fertile rain to the entire continent and the rest of the world. It's like the heart of the planet, pumping moisture and vapor. That's why this COP is important, to put the Amazon on the map, to put indigenous rights central to the debate, and to call for the end of the fossil fuel era. And that's why we're here.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan in Lima, Peru.
Have a little spare time? Always wanted to be in radio? Well, then come on down and get involved in your community radio station, 90.1 FM, KKFI. On the air or behind the scenes, we need your help, and it's lots of fun, too. For more information, call Bill at the KKFI offices at 816-994-7869.
Hey, this is your old pal Mike Murphy. You know, we at KKFI are always bragging about the rich, diverse, talented, deep music scene here in our listening area. Well, that goes for Christmas music as well. Join me Wednesday morning from 6 to 8 for 2 hours of the best of local Christmas music, including, once again, a live in-studio performance from the Snow Globes. That's Wednesday morning from 6 to 8.
The Obama administration was holding about 700 Central American women and children in a small desert town in New Mexico under very poor conditions and without due process. Volunteers who traveled to Artesia, New Mexico to provide legal services will update us on the progress in getting the families released and how the facility has been closed this Wednesday at noon on the All Souls Forum right here on KKFI.
Veterans Voices has enlarged its vision of the writing program to now include all military veterans. Those who are working with veterans groups are encouraged to seek out veterans who are willing to share their stories. For more information, go to veteransvoices.org. This message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
World Ocean Radio.
Radio Ya Bahari Dunia.
Radio de l'Océan.
La Radio Oceano del Mundo.
Champion de l'Océan.
Sayansi Bahari.
Solutions to today's ocean issues.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio.
I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. Considering the great climate change debate, whether it exists or does not exist as a major threat to our future, I'm reminded of the philosopher and inventor Blaise Pascal's famous wager over the existence of God. If you believe in God, you can find solace in peace and salvation. If you do not believe in God, why not hedge your bet? Climate change suggests a similar dilemma. If you don't believe it is real and dire, and it proves to be nothing, then doing nothing leaves you home free. But what if you're wrong? What if you do nothing and thereafter succumb unprepared to the devastating consequence that might follow? Why would you not hedge your bet and at least consider, maybe even define and prepare for the possibility of the predictable risks? Recently, I attended a conference and planning workshop sponsored by the Climate Change Institute, University of Maine, that invited state managers, municipal planners, non-governmental organizations, and interested citizens to take part in a planning exercise to define possible climate change risks, impacts, and vulnerabilities, and to imagine viable responses, to visualize design, price, and prioritize implementation of responses should they be required. It was an exercise in climate risk management, and it was very instructive. Here is a list of climate change risks: increased average surface temperatures, altered air and ocean currents, extreme weather events, increased precipitation, heat waves and cold snaps, melting sea ice, rising sea level, ocean acidification, algal blooms, invasive species, and more. Here is a list of climate change impacts: flooding, drought, fire, agricultural failure, food shortage, water and well pollution, species loss, economic loss, and more. Here is a list of vulnerabilities: environmental degradation, critical pollution, lack of technical and scientific expertise, alienation from political power, regional geographical decline in island, coastal, and inland communities, poor governance structures, community disruption, social and psychological decline, and more. So what about that bet? None of this will matter to you if you do not accept the possibility of any of these risks. But again, what if you're wrong? Are you willing to ignore even the possibility of these circumstances and trends and leave us all to fend for ourselves and defer the consequence of neglect to our children? In that workshop, we accepted the actuality of climate change and then examined what would be the impact on our specific communities, along shore, inland, and in the far north of our state, each with very distinct conditions to be affected differently by such risks. It was revealing and disturbing for certain, but it was also uplifting as we worked as groups of managers and residents from these areas to see what we might do and might invent to sustain our livelihood and place for the future. We were not overwhelmed or discouraged as much as we began to understand the comprehensive impact of what we might face, to analyze its complexity, and to agree on what steps might be taken locally, perhaps with resources already available to us, to meet the challenge. Indeed, there was a palpable communal realization in the room that a group of strangers with varied qualifications and interests could come together to solve the problem, once we agreed amongst ourselves that it exists. In those few hours, we transformed plausible scenarios into possible plans of action. In many cases, we understood that certain circumstances already existed, that the risks were already evident, and that the need for response, regardless of the climate change debate, was a necessary step, no matter what. I have always argued that beyond mitigation and adaptation, the real solution to climate change is invention, the cooperative application of knowledge and experience, not just to maintain or defend the status quo, but rather to imagine and create new solutions to the problems to be faced. I felt that power of invention in that place, and took home renewed optimism that, as always, smart and well-intentioned people can come together to build a sustainable future. I wonder what Pascal would say. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
World Ocean Radio is produced by World Ocean Observatory in association with WERU-FM, Blue Hill, Maine. World Ocean Radio is distributed by the Public Radio Exchange and the Pacifica Network. Find us on iTunes at worldoceanobservatory.org and at stitcher.com.
Good evening. I'm Natural Lee, and I have your local environmental events. On December 26th, we have Christmas tree recycling in Overland Park. It's all day, and it's for those who decorated with a real tree for the holidays. There are opportunities in Overland Park to recycle your tree. Each year, Overland Park allows residents to drop off their Christmas trees during daylight hours at four locations. Your tree will get a second life as mulch. Drop off your tree December 26th through Sunday, January 4th at the following locations: Young's Park, 77th and Antioch, Indian Creek Recreation Center at 103rd and Marty, Quivira Park at 119th and Quivira, and the Overland Park Arboretum and Botanical Gardens at 8909 West 179th Street. Please remove all lights, tinsel, ornaments, presents, and tree stand. It says, yes, sometimes presents are found in the trees. For more information, contact Jim Twigg, the Environmental Programs Coordinator, at 913-895-6273. And for December 27th, all day, they're looking for volunteers to help with the Holiday Recycling Center and to help Bridging the Gap manage the influx of post-holiday waste. Scheduling is flexible. Whatever amount of time volunteers can give is appreciated. Volunteers assist patrons with unloading recyclables and assist the site manager with breaking down cardboard, maintenance, and other needs. Volunteers are needed Saturday, December 27th at two locations: the Three Trails location over by Bannister Complex, 91st and Hillcrest, and the Metro North location at 8729 North Summit Street in Kansas City, Missouri. All volunteers must register in advance. Contact Amy Smith at 816-561-1087, or you can find more information by visiting Bridging the Gap's website.
All right. Thank you very much, Natural E. A couple of housekeeping kind of announcements. The Eco Radio KC folks will be taking the holidays off. So for the next 2 weeks, you'll be hearing a syndicated program called Radio Eco Shock in this time slot, and we're anxious for your feedback on that. So we do wish you all a happy Hanukkah, which starts tomorrow evening, and of course, the solstice starts over the weekend, and Christmas and Kwanzaa start next week. So happy holidays to one and all. And the KKFI holiday online auction ends at 8 o'clock tonight. There's some really great bargains there. You can find out more at kkfi.org, and it helps to support your community radio station. Another way to support your community radio station is the 90.1 FM presents Mind the Gap Club Night, and that's at the Mini Bar at 3810 Broadway. A night of house, deep house, tech house, electro, UK underground, and so much more, hosted by JZ. This will again happen on December 20th, starting at 10 p.m. at the Mini Bar. And once again, I want to remind you, Vandana Shiva will be on alternative radio Wednesday morning. And don't forget that Thursday night special about future car, how cars of the future, from the folks at IEEE Spectrum. And also want folks to know about Bioneers, Generation Green, fulfilling the promise of jobs and justice. So we will be back with a lot more great programs coming up for you in the next year. And we want to thank everyone for showing their support for Eco Radio, for making it a part of your week, whether you listen live or on the podcast. We usually have these podcasts up the next day, so you can listen at your leisure or tell folks, hey, I listened to something very interesting on Eco Radio. Well, I think you might be interested in it, and you can send them that link. These are all great ways of helping to get the word out about community radio, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. I think we'll go out now with something from This Week in Water, the H2O Radio. But I thought what we would do first is just play one more spot about an upcoming program.
This week on Music City Roots, live from the factory, we count our blessings and revel in friendship as we usher in the holidays with two of the most powerful and spiritual voices in Music City. Mike Ferris focuses his fire in a spare set with acoustic guitar and his pal Paul Brown on organ. And we close the show with the mighty Newgrass and blue-eyed soul of John Cowan.
I'll be a song upon the wind. I'll be a wave upon the sea. Well, you know we'll begin again. Six red birds in a Joshua tree.
Also on this show from the eve of Thanksgiving, laid-back and honest songs from Todd Grebe and Cold Country, plus a stunning display of acoustic guitar as bluegrass masters Richard Bennett and Wyatt Rice open the night. All that plus Jim Lauderdale on Music City Roots.
Saturday morning at 7, right before the Blues Kitchen.
Watered down climate talks, a cop-out? That and other news this December 14th, 2014. I'm Franny Halperin.
And I'm Jamie Sudler.
And it's This Week in Water.
The momentum from last month's joint U.S.-China deal on carbon emissions faded quickly at the UN climate talks in Lima, which concluded early this morning, December 14th. As the conference began, disagreements reopened over who should do what to fight global warming.
The goal of the talks, called COP20 for the 20th Conference of the Parties, was to establish each country's commitment in combating global warming at the next UN conference in Paris.
But developed and major polluting countries balked at taking responsibility for their share of pollution. For example, a draft agreement did not address the plight of small island nations threatened by rising sea levels caused by large carbon-emitting countries like the U.S., China, and India.
Early Sunday morning, there was slight movement to compromise. The Lima Agreement states the countries have, quote, common but differentiated responsibilities to deal with global warming.
Environmental groups have reacted fiercely to the Lima conference. The World Wildlife Fund called the agreement a half-baked plan to cut emissions. A spokesperson for Friends of the Earth stated that, once again, poor nations were being bullied by the industrialized world into accepting an outcome that leaves many of their citizens facing the consequences of catastrophic climate change. More than 40 million people depend on the water from the Colorado River, and since 1922, the river has been allocated among seven states by an agreement also known as the Compact.
Last week, Colorado issued a draft plan that seeks to store more water from the river up to the state's legal allotment under the Compact.
In talking about the plan, James Eklund of the Colorado Water Conservation Board said, "If anybody thought we were going to roll over and say, okay, California, you're in a really bad drought, you get to use the water that we're going to use, they're mistaken."
Other states are being more diplomatic in response to Eklund's comments. Arizona's Department of Water Resources told the Associated Press that Arizona has the same interests as Colorado, but that his state would not express it as pointedly as Colorado's water leader did.
And earlier last week, three states, not including Colorado, signed a new agreement to save a portion of their allotments of the river in Lake Mead to boost the lake's levels. Arizona is committing to save the most, which means many of Arizona's farmers will not get as much water as expected.
Cruise ships or ooze ships? According to a new report from the environmental watchdog group Friends of the Earth, cruise ships released over 1 billion gallons of sewage into the oceans in 2014.
Federal law states that these ships can legally dump treated wastewater if they're within 3 nautical miles of a coastline. Beyond that point, the international protocols permit ships to dump as much sewage as they want, with the stipulation that if the sewage is untreated, the ship must be at least 12 nautical miles from the shore.
Cruise ships also released 8 billion gallons of gray water, discharged from sinks, showers, swimming pools that often contains the same pollutants as sewage.
The annual report card by Friends of the Earth, now in its 5th year, found a steady improvement for cruise lines sailing newer, energy-efficient ships. But the report stated that 40% of ships are outfitted with waste treatment technology that's more than 35 years old that allows fecal matter, bacteria, heavy metals, and other contaminants to be disposed of into our oceans.
And speaking of sewage, a Seattle startup has a new idea to power your car, a poop-to-pump scenario, if you will.
Vitruvian Energy has developed technology that turns biosolids, the dirt-like material left over from sewage treatment plants, into biofuel.
Poopaline, as it's become more casually known, is especially promising because it can blend with gasoline and diesel in existing combustion engines, meaning you don't have to develop a specialized biofuel car. And finally this week, for many of us across the U.S., winter is upon us, and that means icy roads.
The ongoing dilemma is how to keep drivers safe without harming the environment.
That problem led the U.S. Department of Transportation to recently establish the Center for Environmentally Sustainable Transportation in Cold Climates.
The center is the only one in the U.S. studying, quote, road ecology that looks for green solutions to promote safety.
To that end, they're tinkering with beet juice combined with salt because the juice prevents the salt from escaping into the ground.
But beet juice is problematic because it has a lot of sugar, which can also be harmful to the environment.
So they're looking at other things, pickle brine and tomato juice. The de-icing solutions they're really excited about? Barley residue from vodka distillation.
Vodka as a de-icer makes sense for anyone who has ever noticed that vodka never seems to freeze, even when you've put a bottle in the freezer.
Vodka? Tomato juice? Sounds like the ingredients of a Bloody Mary might be the center's spirited way to keep us safe on our streets this season. This Week in Water is a production of H2O Radio and is sponsored by Colorado WaterWise. Learn more at coloradowaterwise.org.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Están escuchando KKFI 90.1 FM Kansas City, Radio de la Comunidad. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Latino soy.